him 5.5 years to finish the muqaddamat in the sutuh. The standard time for studying the muqaddamat in the sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei with Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let me ask you this question at the beginning of this episode related to actually the medical issue. A person did not have circumcision. However, there is no foreskin on the penis. Is it obligatory for that individual to actually go through the operation of circumcision?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, if there is no foreskin left or there is no foreskin on the penis, it's not a case of obligatory circumcision because there is no skin, extra additional skin to be removed.
Cut off or removed.
Yeah, to be removed. So therefore, this is not the case where circumcision is obligatory or required. And the issue of circumcision is a matter of, you know, deep controversy. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of debate has been going on among, not only among scholars, but also internationally. When we look at the issue, different people have said different things. The religious authorities have said that circumcision is necessary when a person wants to perform tawaf of the house of God, the Kaaba. Mm-hmm. In order for the tawaf to be valid, of course, it is essential that a Muslim be circumcised. And of course, if a child is born to a Muslim family, it's necessary for the family to take action to get the child circumcised, because it is basically obligatory when there is an extra skin on the genital organ. So that skin must be removed according to Islamic Muslim scholars.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back again continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Just stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, yeah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and we are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to the medical issues based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini with Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, in this time around, women get their eyebrows done by male experts or barbers or whatever. You know, is it permissible for them to do so, to go to the male experts?
Well, as you know, and as our audience also know very well, to get the eyebrows done requires a woman, a doctor, to touch the eyebrows. Mm-hmm. Getting the eyebrows done is permissible in and of itself because there's nothing wrong with it. And Muslim scholars have allowed a woman to shape their eyebrows and to design it or make it beautiful. But any case, but what makes it haram is for a woman is to go to a doctor, to a male doctor, to allow a male doctor to touch it, something which is not necessary. No one sees it or deems it necessary. In common view, it's not necessary at all for a woman to get her eyebrows done, you know. Mm-hmm. And when a doctor touches her, that becomes haram. So it's not permissible for a woman to get it done by a male doctor, male expert.
The same rule apply to doing a tattoo, like by male tattooist?
The same is the case. The problem is the same. Getting a tattoo done on any parts of the
like
of
the eyebrows,
body,
for example.
The eyebrows done, you know, there are women who get tattoos done on their legs, on body parts, you know, different parts of the body. It's not permissible.
I see. Sheikh Javed, we all know the importance of sports and how important it is or what kind of role it can play in our lives, especially in our well-being and health, right?
Sure.
And it is so much emphasized by the doctors today or those people who coach human societies. Well, is it permissible for a woman to go to a gym, to a club, to exercise in a bisexual environment because doctors had advised her, for example, to exercise regularly to boost or improve, for example, their body wealth and well-being, health and well-being? And also, to burn some calories, for example,
right,
if they are overweight, for example. Of course, in lieu of the situation where or the context where there isn't any women-only sports club, for example, around or in that town or village. So what can they do? Is it permissible for these women actually to, exert their energy or to go to the gym there?
Well, the religious scholars are unanimous about the permissibility of exercising, staying in shape, burning calories, and so on and so forth. It is quite good. It's always necessary to have a lifestyle which you know, which makes and which one is constantly exercising, moving, walking, running, you know, because health is wealth, you know. If you're not healthy, you're not going to be, you know, to do anything. So if you come down with an illness, it is going to cost not only your family, but also the whole society. So it's always recommended to exercise, to stay in shape, to burn some calories and to be healthy. But when it comes to going to a bisexual environment, for example, you go to a gym where men are there, women are there, they are exercising together, and they are moving, you know, around, doing the physical workout. You know, this will allow, you know, the other members of the opposite gender to see her, to see her, the shapes of her body. You know, because she cannot wear a loose garment and exercise. The gyms have their own requirements. When you enter the gyms, you have to wear a special outfit, maybe their special dress. And of course, it shows the shape of the woman's body. So it's not permissible, according to Islamic scholars and Shia jurists, to go to a bisexual environment to exercise in such places. And of course, maybe some people might bring up excuses saying, okay, I need to exercise. There's no other place. There's no, you know, gym where only men, women can exercise. What should I do? So the response is that the exercising does not require, you know, a gym. One does not need to go to a gym to exercise. You can, of course, exercise in your own house, in the premises of your own house, without allowing other people to see you. So you can run, you can do certain activities to stay in shape and to burn some calories.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيٍ مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
Since the beginning of Israel's onslaught on Gaza, Western countries and the U.S. in particular have voiced their unequivocal support for Israel and what they call Tel Aviv's right of self-defense, while ignoring the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people. The U.S. President Joe Biden visited Israel shortly after the Israeli military started the massive war on Gaza. Biden unequivocally justified the Israeli regime's genocide in the coastal Gaza Strip, saying Washington would provide the Israeli regime with everything it needed to, quote, defend itself.
Israel has the right, and I would add a responsibility, to respond to the slaughter of their people. And we will ensure Israel has what it needs to defend itself against these terrorists. That's a guarantee.
Analysts believe when it comes to Israel, Biden echoes the policies crafted not in Washington, but in Tel Aviv.
You listen to President Biden, and it sounds like he's reading from an Israeli teleprompter. Line after line after line are lines that you hear from Netanyahu, or you hear from his ministers, or you hear from Israeli propagandists. Line after line after line in the things that the president says, from the beginning of this war until today. Crafted in Tel Aviv, crafted in Jerusalem.
The U.S. president has also promised to ask Congress for an unprecedented military aid package for Israel to assist its ongoing war on Gaza.
For decades, we've ensured Israel's qualitative military edge. And later this week, I'm going to ask the United States Congress for an unprecedented support package for Israel's defense.
The Biden administration has asked for an additional $14 billion for Israel from Congress. This request is focused on providing air and missile defense support and replenishing U.S. military stockpiles given to Israel. Currently, Israel receives $3.8 billion in military aid from the U.S. annually under a memorandum signed in 2019. That accounted for about 16% of Israel's total military budget in 2022. The United States has always made it clear that nothing can stop it from supporting its staunch ally.
We will support them in any way that we can, and certainly intelligence is a part of that, and I won't get into the specifics of what that means, ISR, other types of collection. We've worked with the Israelis, over many, many years, and those sharing mechanisms are there, those channels are there to share information, and we will look to continue to do that.
The U.S. has strong historical and economic ties to Israel. The U.S., which has supported the formation of Israel since World War II, is Israel's top trading partner, with annual bilateral trade of nearly $50 billion in goods and services. As a matter of fact, experts believe the creation of Israel was the direct result of imperial powers' support, including Britain and United States policies.
Without the external support that Zionism received from the British, none of what we have seen in the past century and more would have happened as it did. British and later American and other external support were absolutely essential to the success of the Zionist project from the very beginning.
Shortly after the beginning of the Nakba, or the catastrophe, in which Zionist forces expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians and established Israel, the United States started transferring a huge cache of weapons to Israel. According to data recently published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the United States provided Israel with more than 70,000 weapons between 1950 and 2022. The weapons included aircraft, ground vehicles, missiles, and bombs, most of which were used against the defenseless people of Palestine. Israel is the largest recipient of U.S. foreign military financing, with most of that aid coming in the form of weapons grants. The U.S. has provided Israel with at least 16 types of weapons in 2023, including missiles and aircraft. It is widely believed that U.S. support has emboldened Israel in its atrocities against the Palestinian people. Just recently, even a U.S. State Department official also resigned over the transfer of arms to Israel, amid growing dissent over President Biden's unequivocal support for the regime.
I think we have to look at the situation on the ground and say, is that what is actually happening? Is Israel more secure as a result of our assistance, or has our military assistance enabled Israel to move ahead with the expansion of settlements in the West Bank, to continue the siege of Gaza, and to take steps that ultimately undermine its own security?
In fact, the U.S.-made weapons are being used extensively in the current Israeli operations in Gaza. Apart from ground-penetrating munitions, the U.S. has also given Israel several other types of bombs and artillery shells. The United States has given so-called bunker buster bombs and an array of other munitions to Israel for its war on Gaza. A Wall Street Journal report citing unnamed U.S. officials said Washington has transferred 100 BLU-109 bombs to Israel that are meant to penetrate hardened structures before exploding.
The U.S. has also sent special forces to the occupied territories to assist the Israeli military, according to American officials. The commandos are in Gaza to help the Israeli military in finding captives held by Palestinian fighters. While there is overwhelming bipartisan support for Israel among the American politicians, some critics are now casting doubt on whether spending taxpayer dollars to provide such huge funds serves the interests of the American people.
Yes, there are enormous emergencies abroad, but there are also very serious emergencies in our own country, including the crises we face in child care, in primary health care, housing, and in other needs. The American people do not want us to continue to ignore these issues. I do not believe we should be appropriating over $10 billion for the right-wing extremist Netanyahu government to continue its current military approach. What the Netanyahu government is doing is immoral. It is in violation of international law, and the United States should not be complicit in those actions.
But the question to ask is why the American officials, including Democrats and Republicans, are so committed to supporting Israel, ignoring the needs of their own people.
The simple answer is it's because they're under the thumb of the Israel lobby. Israel has penetrated our government system very effectively through the lobby. This is what you get out of the other end. As far as these people are concerned, you have there is a First Amendment and you have freedom of speech in the United States, unless you're saying something about Israel. And this is appalling. This is disgusting. But the fact is they get away with it because they have such influence around, I would even go further, control over many congressmen. Are major donors to congressmen, and this has an impact. They have major influence over what appears in the media, and this has a major impact on politicians running for office.
However, it seems that the younger American generation no longer buys the propaganda spread by mainstream media, desperately trying to justify U.S. support for Israel. Surveys show a growing number of American youths has an unfavorable view of Israel over its recent genocide in Gaza.
Black intellectuals, Native American intellectuals, Hispanic intellectuals are all much more critical of Israel, especially the younger ones, than are their elders or than are Republicans as a general rule. And this is not just true of young black students or young Latino students or young Arab or Muslim students. It's also true of many young Jewish students. You look at college campuses, and Jewish Voice for Peace is a central component of the drives for divestment of these universities' assets from companies that support the Israeli occupation and of Palestinian rights generally. There's a generational divide.
If once the unconditional support of the Israeli regime was something for U.S. politicians to take pride in, it seems that it's going to cost them politically in the near future, as more and more people in the United States are getting to know more about the realities of the occupied territories.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam was brought up under the care of the Holy Prophet Muhammad when he was just a small child. And so in this manner, the foundation of the moral and spiritual education of this magnificently intelligent child was based by the Prophet of Islam himself, the greatest educator of all mankind. Imam Ali's mental faculties were to an extent that he believed in the Holy Prophet and his mission at the tender age of 8. Therefore, Imam Ali, contrary to the other companions of the Holy Prophet, had never worshipped idols and never partook in the unreasonable demands, the oppressive actions, or the unjust acts of the Arab chieftains.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: الوفاء لأهل الغدر غدر عند الله، والغدر بأهل الغدر وفاء عند الله.
أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام said, faithfulness with faithless people is faithlessness with Allah, while faithlessness with faithless people is faithfulness with Allah.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are unfortunately in the modern day witnessing this genocide that has occurred against the Palestinians at the hands of the Zionist regime. We find that innocent men, women, and children have been killed in this relentless, cruel, and merciless onslaught by the Zionists. Unfortunately, for the large part, the governments of the world have remained silent in the face of these atrocious crimes being committed against humanity. We also find that many of the international organizations of the world have also either remained silent, or if they have not remained silent, well, they have not bothered to do any kind of action in order to protect these innocent men, women, and children. How much could these different political and governmental officials, as well as these international organizations, learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam? Truly, Imam Ali alayhi salam always did his best to protect innocent men, women, and children. And most especially, we find that Imam Ali alayhi salam, he protected women and children and widows and orphans. Women and children in general are a weaker aspect of society. It seems like there is more oppression and cruelty done to women and children because they are weaker aspects in society. But even more weaker than women and children are widows and orphans. And yet, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he took extra special care of these widows and orphans. Many a times he would send food or provisions to these widows and these orphans. He would try his best to make the life of an orphan happy, because of course they have lost one of these aspects of love, which is their father. And so when we look at the situation in Palestine, we look at the amount of women and children that are being killed, or women and children that are being turned into widows and orphans. Truly, we wish that the political and governmental officials of the world, as well as the international organizations who claim to protect human rights, we wish they would take this lesson from Imam Ali alayhi salam. This lesson that mere words are not enough. Action is what is important. And it was Imam Ali alayhi salam who in action and in words, both together, taught us to take care of women and children, to take care of widows and orphans. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارع.
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits his supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands get more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
كل صبح وكل اشراق تبكى عيني بدمع مشتاق قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
I think the best thing would be to go to the words of the Ma'asumin themselves, beginning with the hadith from the sixth Imam, Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, where he talks about the importance of the vilayat of Ali and the Imams who came after him. Where then the Imam says, describing the importance of vilayat, where he says, زَرْوَةُ الْعَمْرِ وَسَنَامُهُ وَمِفْتَاحُهُ وَبَابُ الْعَشْيَا وَرِضَ الرَّحْمَانِ He says, if you really want to understand that what is the apex of the iman, what is the highest level of iman, what is the key of the iman, what is the gate to every good thing, and where lies the pleasure and good pleasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he says, everything depends at-ta'a lil-imam ba'da ma'rifati. Everything depends on obedience to the Imam after having his ma'rifat and after knowing and recognizing him. So ma'rifat of the Imam is the first thing. Obedience to the Imam is the second thing. Everything else is later on. And then Imam goes even further. And this is where I think there's a need to go back to the basics. Because sometimes we take this concept of imamat and vilayat very lightly and we say, well, we are Shias, we don't really need to talk about it more. But there are some very delicate points that we should have in our hearts and minds. And so the sixth Imam goes on to say, وَأَمَّ لَوْ أَنَّ رَجُلًا قَامَ لَيْلَهُ وَصَامَ نَحَارُهُ وَتَصَدَّقَ بِجَمِيعِ مَالِهِ وَحَجَّ جَمِيعَ دَحْرِهِ If a person stands up for prayers for the whole night, every night. And that person fasts every day. And he gives his entire money and wealth in sadaqah and charity. وَحَجَّ جَمِيعَ دَهْرِهِ And does hajj every year. But then, وَلَمْ يَعْرِفْ وِلَايَةَ وَلِيِّ اللَّهِ If such a person who prays every night, fasts every day, does sadaqah completely does hajj every year, but he doesn't have the ma'rifat, doesn't know the imam of the time, so that he may follow him, then imam says, مَا كَانَ لَهُ عَلَى اللَّهِ حَقٌ فِي ثَوَابٍ وَلَا كَانَ مِنْ أَهْلِ الْإِيمَانِ If that person who is doing all these good things doesn't know the imam, doesn't know the wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then Allah has no obligation to reward that individual in the hereafter.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Mother, don't cry for me. I'm heading off to war. God Almighty is my armor and sword. Palestine, forever Palestine. Children being killed for throwing stones in the sky. They say to their parents, don't worry, God is on our side. Palestine, forever Palestine.
Everyone has a beloved. And you, dear friend. I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosro Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr.
He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhide kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program, The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and life account and the biography, scholarly and religious life of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite dignitaries. And in the recent series, we are mainly concerned with outstanding women in Islam. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum to you too, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, thank you.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about another great lady of Islam, Hakima, the daughter of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. She was the daughter of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam and Samana al-Maghribiya, the sister to Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, and she was contemporary to four Shiite infallible Imams: Imam al-Jawad, Imam al-Hadi, Imam Hassan al-Askari, and Imam al-Mahdi al-Jalallah. Really, really outstanding lady of Islam, Hakima Khatun, and we can say the great status that she has among the ladies of Islam. Sheikh Rouhani, give us some information about Hakima, daughter of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Who was she exactly?
Yes, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, she accompanied the many Imams, including Imam al-Hadi, Imam al-Jawad, Imam Hassan al-Askari, and Imam al-Mahdi. And it is said that she was alive until the major occultation of Imam Asr arwahu nafidah. Mm-hmm. And she was in charge of educating and training Narjis, mother of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salatu wasalam. You know, because the mother of the Imam should be trained,
yeah,
and should be a well-qualified personality to bring up the Imam. And she witnessed the birth of Imam al-Mahdi, ajallallahu ta'ala farajuhu sharif. According to Shiite sources, Hakima met Imam al-Mahdi during his minor occultation and played the role of a connection between the Imam and the people.
Mm-hmm.
She was like a wakil or wasi
for
the Imam, yeah.
Yes.
And she also transmitted some ahadith and riwayat from Imam al-Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam. And Shiite scholars and historians admired her as a pious person.
Yes.
And her grave is also located in Samarra.
Yes.
So the father of this lady is Imam al-Jawad. The mother of her is Samana al-Maghribiya. And of course, about the children of, yes, this lady, we can mention that Hussein, Zayd, and Hamza, they, yes, were the children of this great lady. She was buried in Samarra in Surra Man Ra'a.
That's all right. Sayyid Mahdi, she accompanied four infallible Imams. She was, they say, the trustee, or it's better to say, that's right, the saving box of the asrar of four infallible Imams, you know, especially the last Imam, Imam Asr. And this shows the great status of Hakima. Give us some information about the religious and the scholarly life of this outstanding lady.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So when it comes to the religious aspect of Lady Hakima, of course, one of the things that we find is that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam had assigned her to train Lady Nargis.
Mm-hmm. Nargis. Both of them are right.
And so this in itself is, it's quite important. It's something that's noteworthy. This idea that an infallible imam, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has requested Lady Hakima to do this kind of training. And this training is spiritual training, akhlaqi training, religious training.
Yes.
Of course, Lady Hakima, she was the daughter of an infallible imam. She's the sister of a infallible imam, and eventually she's the aunt of an infallible imam as well. So,
yes.
She's a very knowledgeable individual. She's very pious. Of course, one of the things that's related is that she had transmitted many traditions and ahadith from the infallible imams. What's interesting is that there's a very famous hirz
of
Imam Jawad alayhi salam, which is very common across
the
Shia.
What is hirz exactly?
So this hirz, I don't want to call it an amulet.
It's a kind of religious formula for protecting people or something like that?
I guess you could call it a religious formula, yes. Really, there are these statements or du'as or the names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which protect an individual.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, even if you write on a piece of paper, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, and you keep it upon you, or Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, these kind of things have a effect and an impact. And so this hirz of Imam Jawad,
of which is very much famous and used by the people, is quoted from Hakima.
It's quoted from Hakima Khatun, from Lady Hakima, which, it's interesting. It's a big deal because it's probably one of the most important and well-known hirz and this
protection. Most of the Shiite children in Iran, maybe they have a necklace or armband or something like that which there is writing of hers of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, of course, it depends very much on the wordings, whether it is authentic or not, okay?
Right,
so,
right.
But it is among the popular culture of the people. So this legacy is given to us by Hakima Khatun now.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. That's right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And Sheikh Rouhani, nurturing Nargis Khatun. By the order of Imam Hassan al-Askari, Hakima was in charge of nurturing and teaching Nargis Khatun. She was the first lady who witnessed the holy face of, we can say, Imam Asr. And all this give us just more details about this, picture of her life. Her presence by Imam As and Nargis Khatun.
Hakima is a word that is rooted in hikmah, means wisdom.
Yes.
Hakim means wise man. Mm-hmm. Hakima means wise woman, lady. Mm-hmm. This title, which is given to this lady, is because of this that she was known for her knowledge, that she was a wise and knowledgeable figure. This was the reason that she was appointed by Imam al-Hadi alayhi salatu wassalam as the trainer or as the teacher and master of the Nargis, mother of the holy Imam Asr wa Huna Fida. So when someone is appointed by Imam al-Masum, by the infallible Imam, as the trainer or the teacher of mother of an Imam, so of course this lady must be of highest level of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And she must be Hakim, she must be wise,
yes,
a knowledgeable figure. That is why we see that this great lady, Hakima Khatun, was such a lady that she had this responsibility to train and to teach Narges, mother of Imam al-Hamdi.
Was there any special training for Narges, especially because, as we said in our previous programs, Narges was taken as a servant to the house of Imam Hasan al-Askari and now becoming the mother of the, we can say, the only Imam who is going to be this last savior of the world, okay? For instance, there must be some, for example, asrar, secrets given to her or some special teachings?
Yeah, exactly. This is the point that we should mention regarding this Narges, because Ummahatul A'imma, mothers of A'imma alayhim salatu wasalam, we believe that they were chosen by the A'imma alayhim salatu wasalam themselves,
yes,
as their wives. You know, sometimes, for example, for some of the A'immas, alayhim salatu wasalam, we have many wives, but only one of them, that majority of them are among the maidens and servants, they became the wives of A'imma, alayhim salatu wasalam. It seems that A'imma knew that who will be the mother of the next, for example, Imam. That's why it is mentioned in historical sources and all different sources like narrations and also the hadithi sources, historical sources. These events mentioned that sometimes A'imma alayhim salatu wasalam sent their, for example, people to find that, for example, specific woman from among the maidens and servants, and they should brought them into their house. So Narges, the mother of Imam al-Mahdi, Ali ajallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif, was also the same. And since it is said that this Narges, of course, some says that she was from Greece.
And some Roman Empire, for
Roman
example,
Empire,
Rome,
yeah.
That's
but
right.
But there are some other views as well.
Yes.
But anyhow, she was a servant and she was not Arab.
Yes.
And she was taken as to the house of Imam al-Askari alayhi salatu wasalam. And she was chosen as the wife of Imam Hasan al-Askari to be the mother of the 12th Imam.
Yes.
So, of course, this lady need to be trained.
To be trained and
yeah,
to be protected.
By a scholarly lady.
Yes.
So that lady was Hakima Khatun Ridwanullahi ta'ala alayha.
Yes.
And of course, as you rightly mentioned, she saw the Imam al-Mahdi ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu al-Sharif.
She was also a kind of intermediate between Imam
As
and Ghaibat al-Sughra among
the
people the
minor
around. This shows again the great status of this lady. Okay, Sayyid Mahdi, anything missed? We got about 2 minutes, your final remarks.
Yeah, I guess, and this is something that we've been talking about in all of our programs, you know, here where we're talking about these auspicious female personalities in Islam. And what we see is that the closer we get to the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, we really find the status that they have given to women, which not only at that time is a status which was much greater than what the rest of the general population would give to women. But even in the present day, we see that this status that has been given to these auspicious personalities who are female by the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, is something that's not seen in the present day either. And so it's very refreshing for, you know, the listeners out there to go and do some research on these auspicious personalities and how the imams treated them and how the imams, alayhimus salam, they treated women, how they treated slaves, how they treated other people, how they treated foreigners. And you really find a very refreshing and beautiful, you know, Islamic aspect on what really humanitarian and you know, taking care of fellow human beings means.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the life account of Hakima, daughter of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, and Saman al-Maghrabiya, the sister of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, who was in charge of the teaching and nurturing Narges Khatun, also taking care of Imam al-As, Imam al-Mahdi. She was among the people who, among the first people who visited the holy face of Imam As. She was a kind of intermediate between the people and Imam As in Ghaibat al-Sughra, and really, really outstanding lady. Her holy tomb is placed in Haram Askariyain in the holy city of Samarra.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much to your listeners for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam PhD. Another episode. God bless you. Fiamat.
A teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures. Oh Allah, we've shamed ourselves, we've strayed from Al-Mu'allim. Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. I'm Saeed Pourreza, with you for some of the biggest talking points coming out of Israel's ongoing genocidal war on Gaza and its intensifying raids in the West Bank. But before anything, a quick look at some of the most recent developments. As the Israeli regime steps up its deadly U.S.-Europe war on Gaza, despite rising domestic and international pressure for it to stop, the latest series of Israeli airstrikes have killed more than 200 Palestinians across the Gaza Strip. Hospitals continue to be targeted, where hundreds of people have been taking shelter to escape the bombings. The UN says Gaza is becoming a graveyard for a population trapped between war, siege, and deprivation. Human Rights Watch accuses the Israeli regime of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza. Also coming up, a look at the daily struggle of the Palestinians living under apartheid and military occupation. The U.S. Defense Secretary is holding talks with Israeli officials in Tel Aviv, and stories of defiance, resilience, and hope among the undefeatable people of Gaza amidst the bloodshed. Plus, the continuing fallout from the U.K. government's abstention from voting for a ceasefire at the U.N. General Assembly earlier this month, described by activists and political opponents as shameful. As the Israeli Prime Minister vows to push ahead with this genocidal war on Gaza, where does global public opinion stand on it? Will international and domestic pressure force the Israeli regime to stop the killing spree? And what does the post-massacre world look like for Palestinians and the Israeli regime? Those questions and more with filmmaker Angelica Gale, right here in the studio with me, and from Baghdad, Iraq, chemical engineer and political analyst Batul Subaiti. Thank you both for joining the program. I'll start the program usually, Angelica, with a question about your description of what is unfolding in the Gaza Strip and, of course, the stepped-up attacks by the Israeli occupation forces in the West Bank.
It's personally, I think, it's a massacre. I think at first, at the beginning of, well, when October 7th happened, my engagement in the wider media and what was happening wasn't a lot. And I think throughout time, I started to build up a picture myself using social media, using other outlets, as to what was really happening and also the complicity of the West and why they have such strong opinions in it and why they won't advocate for a ceasefire. And right now, what I see what's happening is a continual settler project, an Israeli settler project, continuing the colonial tirade in which they've put onto Palestinian people for the past 75 years, with the support of the West, with the support of the US and the UK within that, providing a diplomatic cover and also providing military aid and what they can do to try and continue the Zionist movement, essentially. And, you know, you can talk as much as you want about the Balfour Declaration, and how the UK had such a, you know, they were the ones who formed it in the first place and giving that land to the Zionist project. But I think now it's just very simply a case of people dying, essentially, and we are allowing to happen, and we are facilitating the death of thousands of women, children, and men in the West Bank and in Gaza. And so if you dilute it to just that, it's a case of whether or not you are on the side of humanity or you're not, rather than any political alliance or anything like that. And, you know, I am just a person.